Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In a global context of widespread fears over Islamic radicalization and militancy, poor Muslim youth, especially those socialized in religious seminaries, have attracted overwhelmingly negative attention. In northern Nigeria, male Quranic students have garnered reputation of resorting to violence in order to claim their share of highly unequally distributed resources. Drawing on material from long-term ethnographic and participatory fieldwork among Quranic students and their communities, Quranic Schools in Northern Nigeria, Everyday Experiences of Youth, Faith, and Poverty, published by Cambridge University Press in 2018, offers an alternative perspective on youth, faith, and poverty. Mobilizing insights from scholarship on education, poverty research, and childhood and youth studies, Hannah Hochner describes how religious discourses can moderate feelings of inadequacy triggered by experiences of exclusion, and how Quranic school enrollment offers a way forward in constrained circumstances, even though it likely reproduces poverty in the long run. In our conversation, we discuss the rural economy of northern Nigeria, educational options for young boys, the activities of the Quranic school, how boys support themselves through domestic service, youth masculinity, poverty and economic instability, the politics of respectability, the prayer economy and spiritual services, and participatory research and video production. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Book Network. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Hannah Hochner about Quranic schools in northern Nigeria, everyday experiences of youth, faith, and poverty. Welcome, Hannah, to New Books in Islamic Studies. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about your book, Quranic Schools in Northern Nigeria. We always start a little bit about the author, though. So can you tell us a little bit about your background or training, moments or influences that shaped kind of the questions you are interested in answering or the types of places you're interested in studying? What brought you to your research?
Yeah, definitely. I have quite an interdisciplinary background, which is also reflected in the book. So my undergraduate was actually in international relations, and then I did a master's in development studies at the University of Oxford. And there I had courses in the anthropology and sociology of childhood and anthropology more widely. And I think these were quite important influences for me finding the topic of this book. And then also the topic of my PhD. So already for my master's, I started working on Quranic education in northern Nigeria, and then I dug deeper for my PhD, also on Quranic education in northern Nigeria. Yeah.
So how did this kind of start for you? Where did this kind of come onto your radar, and then how did this start to develop as a project for you?
Yeah, so a little bit by accident. I did an internship in microfinance during my undergraduate in Senegal. And I didn't particularly enjoy the internship, unfortunately, but that was the first context where I was exposed to the Quranic education system in West Africa. And there are lots of similarities across all of West Africa or Muslim West Africa with very similar Quranic education systems. And so I should maybe say about this system that it is schools where boys and young men come to live with a teacher away from home. So it's sort of a boarding school, but often with very limited resources and no elaborate structure. And many of the younger students are out on the street and often beg for their sustenance. So they beg for food. They also beg for money. And so they're very visible, and they're very visible in Dakar, where I did this internship. And everybody talks about them. Everybody complains about them. Everybody has a very strong opinion about them. And I found that quite intriguing. And I felt what is actually missing from that conversation is the point of view of these young people in these schools. How do they see their own education, and what are their opinions? And so I think I got interested in studying their opinions with this background of the anthropology and sociology of childhood that puts a lot of emphasis on speaking with young people themselves and giving them the right to also voice their opinions and to also be heard in research. So that's where my interest came from, that I felt their perspectives are actually missing, but everybody talks about them with a lot of passion and emotion. And then I ended up going to Nigeria because my supervisor at the time, Professor Masuda Bano, she was involved in a DFID-funded education project in northern Nigeria in Kano, and felt that linked up nicely with my research interests. And then I continued on to the PhD because I felt I hadn't answered all the questions I wanted to answer within the space of my master's dissertation, and was then supervised by Professor Abdulrauf Mustafa, who's Nigerian himself, and was very happy for me to continue my work in Nigeria. And he's very sadly passed away in 2017, so before the book came out.
That's too bad. So much of the project is coming out of the field work that you did. So can you give us a snapshot of this time in Nigeria? How did you approach your field experience? What were like the primary sites you were at? What challenges did you face in that context?
Yeah, so my approach was very ethnographic. So I spent 3 months for my master's research in Kano, and then 11 months for my PhD research. And I've been back in 2018 for 6 weeks. And so, yes, my aim was to spend as much time as possible in or near Quranic schools and with Quranic students to understand their lived experience from their point of view. Now, I'm white, I'm a woman, I'm not a Muslim, I'm an adult. And so all of that set me apart from the Quranic students whose experiences I was interested in. I'm also, have quite a different socioeconomic status to these boys and young men who are mostly from poor rural families. And so getting access was quite a challenge and pushed me to be quite creative with my methods. So I lived in a neighborhood right next door to a Quranic school that allowed me to befriend the students of that school eventually. So often they came to visit our compound where Europeans had been living for several years. And so that household had a reputation for having unconventional adults, if you want, that play with children or that need to learn Hausa, so the lingua franca in northern Nigeria. So I interacted with Quranic students by virtue of living in that neighborhood where there was a Quranic school just next door in urban Kano. I also lived in a rural part of Kano state for 4 months in the household of the traditional ruler there. And in that household, there were also Quranic students who were working there. And I interacted with them in that household. But then I also ended up teaching English to Quranic students in different schools, both in urban Kano and then in Albasu, the rural area, often on Thursdays and Fridays, which are the weekend days of the Quranic school, so the students have a bit more time for other things. And that was one way of getting to know them and interacting with them regularly. Now, being a teacher comes with a set of assumptions that you have authority, that you're somehow a bit apart from your students. And so that wasn't ideal necessarily for building up an equal relationship. And so I also experimented with other techniques. In my master's, I used participatory photography. So Quranic students took pictures of things that were important to them and we discussed the photos. And that was a great tool to get access to aspects of the Quranic students' lives that I didn't necessarily have access to otherwise. So I wasn't allowed into the mosque, for example, where lessons were taking place. I couldn't follow the Quranic students when they went begging, for example. Probably that wouldn't have helped them earn anything if a white person stands right next to them. So these photos were a great source of insight. Then the Quranic students also conducted what I've called radio interviews with each other. So I used to tape record some of our conversations and showed the young people how the tape recorder worked, and they found it quite entertaining to hear their own voices played back. And so I encouraged them to play journalists and to interview each other as part of the research, and that worked really well. And it was quite enjoyable to the Quranic students to have this more playful form of expressing their views and concerns. But a very big part of my master's project was the production of a participatory docudrama. So that idea for producing a film together with Quranic school students emerged as I found the other ways of interacting that I had to some extent limiting. And so I was always on the lookout for new reasons for spending time with them, new reasons for learning about their opinions. And also, I should say, I've just kept encountering these very stereotyped, very negative ideas about Quranic education. And I felt a film would be a great way of giving Quranic students a space to portray the education system from their point of view and to counter these very stereotyped depictions. And yes, so that's how the idea for the film came about. I managed to secure a bit of funding from the Goethe Institute, which is a German cultural foundation that supports cultural projects. They've left Kano now, but they were still operating there in 2011 when I did this project. So I had a bit of funding from them. Then I recruited 9 Quranic students from different schools that I had been interacting with before as I was teaching English, and then the school that I was living next to in Kano. So 9 students then received training in filmmaking skills from professionals from the Kannywood film industry. So that's, I don't know if listeners are familiar with Nollywood, the Nollywood film industry, the Nigerian film industry. There's also a Kano-based film industry, Kannywood. And so we had 2 professional filmmakers from that industry and that provided training to the Quranic students in filmmaking. Now, I should say that many of these Quranic students haven't been to formal education. They didn't know anything about filmmaking. I didn't either. But it was a really challenging and interesting project to get everybody to the point where we were able to produce this docudrama together, which has been very well received and has won a prize in Nigeria and has been screened at a couple of international film festivals as well. And so this film portrays the trajectory of a Quranic student, or Al-Majiri, as they are called in Hausa, from the rural village where he comes from to the city where he's involved in the Quranic school. And then it describes all the challenges and difficulties that he encounters, abuse from the rich in society that exploit his labor as a household help and don't really care well enough for him. Then also difficulties finding food, finding soap to wash his clothes, all these challenges that Quranic students encounter in their daily lives. And then eventually he graduates happily and teaches younger students. So it's a happy ending. So this producing this film was a real goldmine in terms of data, because I spent plenty of time with the 9 Quranic students that were part of the production process and learned through spending the time about their experiences. And then obviously the film also gave rise to conversations about what they wanted to present on screen, what were the key messages they wanted to get across to wider society. And that was very much about countering stigma, about emphasizing their morality, emphasizing or challenging negative conceptions that associate Quranic education with negative outcomes, becoming hoodlums, becoming terrorists in the context of Boko Haram, etc. So I learned about all of these concerns throughout the film production process, and these are also key themes in the book. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
No, that was great. And the docudrama is really great. I think it could actually be used in our classrooms as well as a way to kind of introduce a lot of the work you do in the book, much more developed, of course. But you know, if you only have a week to focus on something, it's a really good way to kind of get at a lot of these questions and tensions that are happening in this religious education in Nigeria. I think it could be really useful.
I've used it in some of my teaching, yeah, and it's available on YouTube, so anybody who would like to watch it can find it. It has English subtitles. Makes it. There's also a French a version that's subtitled in French, if that's of any interest to anybody.
So before we get into more of the kind of the nitty gritty, can you give us kind of a snapshot or a bigger portrait of the Al-Majri system? What should we kind of know in general about it? Where does it fit into kind of the social and economic context of the region? And how do you kind of hinted this already, but how does kind of the broader society view students in this schooling system?
Yeah. So first of all, it's not only an education system that exists in northern Nigeria. There's similar education systems all across Muslim West Africa or the West African Sahel. So I think sometimes in Nigeria, I encountered opinions on the system that said it's a Hausa problem. But actually, no, it's a much wider phenomenon in that exists in other societies as well. And I think it is closely related to the agricultural economy and the kind of the climatic conditions in that particular region. So these are schools, often they are mobile, they move with follow seasonal agricultural rhythms. So often students move to urban areas during the dry season when there isn't much agricultural work to be done, and then return home to help farm during the rainy season. Or sometimes entire schools move between rural and urban area according to the agricultural season. So it fits in very well with this larger climate and agricultural system that is very where demand for labor is very seasonal. Now, it is one form of education, of Islamic education, in a context where there are also other forms of education. So we have the kind of government secular education system that has been introduced by the British under colonial rule, and that has since then gained prominence and produced kind of the political elite. There are lots of issues with this education system and inequalities, where often poor rural communities have access only to very poor quality education and without necessarily opportunities to find employment with that education later on. So that's the modern education system. Then there's also a modern Islamic education system, which is more a kind of a day school based system that resembles the secular modern education system that we probably all are familiar with quite closely. So students would in these schools would sit in a classroom with desks, have a blackboard, notebooks, etc., and learn Islamic subjects, but also sometimes secular subjects. Now, that's these are the kind of the more formal education systems, if you want. And then the Quranic education system is quite different, and many people label it informal. Now, I'm not sure if these distinctions, formal and informal, are very helpful, but these Quranic schools are very different in that they don't have all this formal infrastructure, and often a school is based around a teacher's personality, and students come to live with a teacher. So girls might attend Quranic schools as day students and then return home to their parents, but boys and young men often come to live with the teacher, often for a long, you know, several years even. Now, teachers might have space to shelter students, but sometimes they don't. So students are sheltered in the neighborhood. Neighbors might accommodate them in their entrance rooms to their houses. Sometimes they sleep in the open. So that raises a series of issues around these young people's well-being, as they might not have access to sanitary facilities or proper shelter where they can sleep, sheltered from the seasons. Also, as the teachers often don't have means to for the upkeep of their students, they are very much responsible for feeding themselves. So younger students would beg often for food, sometimes also for money to buy things like soap or new shoes, new clothes, these kind of things. And many of the younger students work as domestic helpers. So they would work in houses in the neighborhood. It's a context where many women are quite strictly secluded. So they wouldn't go out during the day or without their husband, and then rely on children as go-betweens to run errands for them, to fetch water, take out the dustbin, buy food, etc. And so often Quranic students do these kind of jobs while they are younger. Older Quranic students often work in the petty economy, all kinds of petty trading. Some are motorbike taxi drivers. So they have all kinds of professions in the petty economy to sustain themselves. And all of that is because the school doesn't receive any money from the government. It's completely community-based. And so the young people in these schools need to organize their own upkeep. Now, these Quranic schools focus very much on memorization of the Quran. So especially beginners start very much with only the Quran as their subject, which they learn to read, write, and recite using wooden boards called alu in Hausa. So it's quite different from the quote-unquote modern education system where people use blackboards and desks and books, notebooks and pens, etc. So here it's a wooden board and ink that students use. And what they mostly learn is to read and recite the Quran in comparison to the other schools that have a broader curriculum, if you want. You also asked me about perceptions of these schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. So there are plenty of misconceptions or plenty of concerns about these schools from different positions. So the kind of international development community is concerned about them being quote unquote out of school because they don't attend the formal education system, don't learn secular subjects. So often they're considered to be out of school or counted as out of school, even though they obviously attend some form of education. Then there are concerns from child rights advocates about these children being abandoned or being exploited because they fend for their own upkeep. So there's a lot of negative perceptions of their parents not taking responsibility for them and just sending them off to live with a teacher without providing for them. Now, often the parents don't have the means to provide for them. And there are also ideas around our children needing to learn to fend for themselves that can explain that. But that's another of the negative perceptions of the system. And then there are lots of security concerns as well, often based on very flimsy or even no evidence, where Quranic school students are associated with political violence, where people think they are easily recruited into political violence or radical groups such as what is popularly called Boko Haram, the insurgents in northeastern Nigeria. So often there's rather limited evidence to back up these claims, but because people have gotten so used to thinking negatively about these Quranic schools, these kind of accusations and suspicions are very dynamic and people are very likely to believe them even if there's not much evidence. And this isn't part of the book, but most recently we've seen this dynamic in the context of the COVID pandemic, where Quranic school students were very swiftly cast as being vectors of disease, even when there was no epidemiological evidence to back that up, just because perceptions are so negative that any accusations easily chime with people's preconceived ideas.
So you zoom in to the kind of rural communities to think about how families manage these educational options and the choices they make. So can you tell us a little bit about how rural families make sense of this kind of range of educational options? And then what's some of the logic behind boys becoming Quranic students as opposed to other options?
Yeah, so I think it's, first of all, we need to have a look at the alternatives that are available, and the modern secular education available in rural areas is of pretty poor quality. Often the teachers are very poorly trained, and there's also quite a bit of corruption within the system where it's very difficult for children from poor rural families to actually advance through that system, because getting good exam results or getting a place in a secondary school is a bit of a question of luck, but also a question of purchasing power and having the right connections. So it's difficult for rural families to make their children progress through this system. So that's quite a difficult option. There's also lots of costs associated with this and presumably free education system, where students have to pay for uniforms and books and pens, and then there are all kinds of levies to buy chalk or to buy a broom to clean the classroom. So it's kind of a constant drain of money that many families just don't have the means to afford for an education that has very uncertain future benefits. So that's a government education system. Then there's the modern Islamic education system that is called Islamia schools is the name used in northern Nigeria. Now, these schools are also mostly fees-based. And again, students need uniforms, etc. And that makes it, again, more difficult for families to enroll their children there on a long-term basis. And so the Quranic education system has the advantage of being much cheaper. And here the idea, the ideology behind it is that students build up a long-term relationship with their teacher. When they don't have the means to give anything to their teacher, then that is not a problem. They're not expelled. They can continue their studies. And the expectation is that eventually, once they have graduated, that they will maintain that relationship with their teacher and support the teacher then. So it's a very different conception of the relationship between teacher and student and of education, where maybe the more modern formal education system is more commodified, whereas this Quranic education system is much more based around long-term relationships and long-term loyalties. So that's kind of the context in which poor rural families opt for this education system. I should also say that the rural economy in northern Nigeria has been declining for many years, has been neglected by the government. So there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of seasonal food scarcity. And the Quranic education system provides relief in these circumstances, where families can alleviate their subsistence burden during times of scarcity and then still draw on the labor of children in the Quranic education system for the farming season when they need their help.
So as you move on, you follow the students kind of from the rural communities into urban centers. And in addition to what they're doing in the schools, you look at how they support themselves, which you've kind of hinted to in terms of things like begging and things like this. But another part of it is domestic service for the more affluent. So can you talk a little bit about this relationship, especially in the context of what you've told us about how these students are generally perceived? You know, how should we understand their domestic service to more affluent Nigerians?
Yes, let me put that question in the context of how the Imam today, how the Quranic students are talked about. So often the kind of the problems that people perceive outsiders of the system often see that the problem is with the parents that neglect their children and with the teachers that aren't providing for the students. But from the point of view of the students, the sources of abuse are actually elsewhere. And so many of them work as domestic helpers. And many of the students perceive that relationship to be actually a source of abuse and exploitation rather than the parents or the teachers. So often these relationships are, and the terms of these employment relationships aren't very well defined. So there is no formal employment contract. And what the Quranic students aspire to is some kind of long-term relationship, a patron-client relationship where their employers will take responsibility for their well-being in the long term and in a comprehensive way. But often employers aren't very keen to have these responsibilities. And so the sense that the students have is that their employers just care about them as a source of labor rather than as a person with a set of needs. And so that's a very tense relationship where the Quranic students in my research held very critical views of the wealthy in society and felt they aren't living up to their responsibilities and aren't taking care of poorer people in society as they should. Now, my research was mostly with the Quranic students, so their opinions are given pride of place in my work. Now, from the employer side, there is also the question of their finances, obviously, and economically, Northern Nigeria has been suffering a lot with rising insecurity, falling oil prices, etc. So it's difficult also for people who the Al-Majirai might consider to be rich.
Now, the economic status of these students, generally in poverty, you look at how they use religious discourses to kind of make sense of this, this social standing. So can you tell us about how does Islam play into these students understanding their role in Nigerian society?
Yes. So I was very surprised to find that even poor people look down on poverty. So being poor can be quite stigmatizing or can carry quite a lot of negative connotations. And so most of the Quranic students come from poor rural families. In my research, that is something that they often tried not to not to reveal straight away. That was quite a concealed aspect that I often only found out after being in contact with other members of their family or after knowing them for a long time, that actually their enrollment was caused by quite constrained conditions in their family. Now, in this context where poverty has negative connotations and where they were trying to hide the material poverty of their families, they could adopt religious discourses about themselves being devoted searchers for sacred knowledge and take and cast deprivation as a necessary condition for seeking knowledge and for becoming religiously learned. So in a way, these religious discourses about frugality and asceticism help them maintain faith in a context where being poor is looked down upon. And so this justification of the Quranic education system as being about learning to endure, to show patience, to be able to stand on one's own feet. These discourses actually help them maintain faith when confronted with negative discourses about poverty, because they were able to reinterpret this poverty as something positive and educative. And in the book, I compare that to kind of Boy Scout displays of Boy Scout style displays of toughness, of being able to eat any food, whatever food you are offered, you'll be able to eat it. Your stomach will be able to cope with it because you've been through so much. So there was a certain pride in being able to cope with difficult circumstances for the sake of acquiring religious knowledge.
Yeah, and related to this, you look at what we might think of as kind of the social politics of respectability. So what strategies did these boys employ to pursue a respectable social position And then how were these types of approaches received by the larger community?
Yes. So in a way, they try to portray the al-Majlisi as being particularly moral and pious individuals and distinguish themselves from other members in society by saying, well, we are particularly, we know what is good moral behavior, and we don't do these things that maybe the children that go to the government school do. We don't play footballs on the day that we're supposed to study. And so in a way, they describe themselves as having this code of conduct that help them feel better about themselves and to distinguish themselves from others in society by emphasizing their morality and often saying, you know, as an al-Majlisi, one should do this or that, and taking pride in this identity as a Quranic student by emphasizing the moral credentials that come with it. They also, yes, emphasized that as Quranic students, they were more diligent with the Quran and were more pious, and that people who failed to support Quranic students lacked faith and lacked piety. So they used religion and morality to emphasize their own credentials and to feel a bit better about themselves in the face of denigration. So especially when these students beg, they experience quite a lot of abuse. And then also in the houses where they work, they experience abuse. So being able to have recourse to morality and to piety help them deal with these really difficult experiences.
In this context, and in elsewhere in the book, but it reminded me in this chapter that while you're primarily focusing on these children and boys, women in society, they're interacting with them in various contexts. So can you talk about this kind of relationship between these often young boys and Nigerian women that they're in contact with? What's the kind of relationship? How do the boys kind of navigate their identity in relation to women in society? It's kind of all through the book, so I don't have a real pointed question, but I'd love to hear kind of how this kind of gendered aspect of the boy's identity as a man or masculinity is being shaped.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. And for anybody who finds the time to watch the film, they'll see that most of the women in that film actually play very negative roles. There aren't really any particularly positive female characters in the film. And that might be an accident, but it might also represent an experience that often the relationship that these Quranic students have with women in their lives are quite strained, especially in their work roles as domestic helpers. Their domestic help is very much managed by women, and being under the authority of a woman can be experienced as being humiliating. And then there's also the additional aspect of many households being financially tight, and so women are responsible for managing the household budget, and so they might have to argue out why they can't give higher wages to their employees. And that can create a lot of tension, whereas the male household head is kind of beyond all of this nitty gritty of the household budget management and day to day relationships. So I think that's also a source of why these relationships can be quite tense, because women are managing this domestic employment contract and or this domestic employment relationship, which many Quranic students experience as exploitative and not particularly supportive.
So the later half of the book, or the later section of the book, you focus on kind of moving out and how these students kind of fare in the broader Nigerian context. And you talk about the so-called prayer economy, or the political economic significance of this religious knowledge more broadly. So can you tell us about the kind of landscape of spiritual services, what types of religious application the al-Majlisi acquire, what types of opportunities does it open up for them, or perhaps challenges?
Yeah, so the spiritual or the prayer economy is about the religiously learned providing services to people in exchange for support. So that might be potions. It's called Rubutun Sha in Hausa. So it's basically writing to be drunk. So that's Quranic verses that are written on a wooden board and then washed off and then drunk. And so that's one form, one thing that Quranic students might provide. Or then there's adua or supplications where Quranic students might recite the Quran for the benefit of someone else. And people seek these kind of services mostly for social problems. So that might be things like depression or a difficult marriage or a difficulty finding a husband. Or people might also seek these kind of spiritual services to have success in with their business or to have success in politics. So all kinds of social uses. And Quranic students or Quranic teachers provide these services. Often they hope to have a long-term relationship with a patron that will support them in the longer term. But often these exchanges have now turned into one-off cash for service relationships. So don't provide much job security if you want. There's also the issue that the prayer economy is increasingly crowded. So there are the graduates of Quranic schools, but now there's also this modern Islamic education system, which graduates from the Quranic education system have to compete with. And that makes it increasingly difficult for graduates of the Quranic education system to make a living within the spiritual economy, within the prayer economy.
Now, you also look at beyond this prayer economy, are there opportunities that this type of education provides for students, or what alternatives might this group of young men have?
Yeah, what it definitely provides is experience in the petty economy, in the petty urban economy, and context within the economy. Because students learn to fend for themselves for such a long time, and they develop skills in the petty economy and context. And many of them, after graduating, move back to the rural areas where they came from, but then continue to engage in seasonal migration, where they come to the urban centers during the dry season, and then continue with petty trade or activities in the petty economy. And they have mostly acquired the skills for doing that from their time as a Quranic student and context that they can rely on. Now, there's a lot of concern in Nigerian discourses, in the media, around the future of Quranic students. But I argue that I don't find it clear whether their prospects are really worse than the prospects of other undereducated urban rural youth who might not have access to capital or professional skills training. So maybe we also need to question these categories, whether we should really discuss them as being very separate from other young people whose educational trajectories might also have been interrupted. And that's something I would also like to emphasize, that many students of the Quranic education system aren't purely products of the Quranic education system. Many of them have been to other forms of education for a couple of years, and then maybe financially they weren't able to continue, or some of them go to adult literacy classes, so they also seek to diversify their knowledge and their education, or to go to modern Islamic education. So these categories are also a little bit blurred, and the difficulties that poor young people in northern Nigeria face are very much shared across a wider demographic.
Now, the book you must have wrapped up a little bit of time ago, but I know that the field work, the primary field work you did was some time ago now. Can you talk about anything that might be changing in Nigeria society? Do you suspect the social realities have shifted significantly since your field work, or Have you been in touch with any of these students or others that that might make us rethink the kind of role of the El Madri?
Yeah, I've been in touch. I think if anything, conditions probably have become worse. I think that is related to the insecurity. So there has been insecurity related to the Boko Haram conflict, but there has also been insecurity related to criminal activities in larger parts of northwestern Nigeria. So the Boko Haram conflict is very much in northeastern Nigeria, but there's also increasing insecurity in all of the north and in northwestern Nigeria. So this insecurity has nurtured suspicions against the Quranic education system that have been there for decades. There were always these misgivings or suspicions that the Quranic education system would produce miscreants or problems. But that has been reinforced by this insecurity, and Quranic students are easy scapegoats in many situations, something that I also explore in the book, how having low social standing makes them easy scapegoats, and then accusations develop a life of their own, if you want, because their standing is low. It's kind of convenient to accuse them of negative things that happen. And because their standing is low, they can't really defend themselves, so can't really speak back. So these accusations are taken to be true. So insecurity definitely matters. Then there's also the impacts of the COVID pandemic, which was a really, really big problem economically for many people and has likely increased poverty. So in a way that might further constrain families in terms of the means they have to send their children to other forms of education. And these other forms of education have also been closed for a long time because of COVID and insecurity. Mm.
So the book covers a lot of ground. There's obviously greater detail, and the kind of ethnographic narrative that you paint is really, I mean, we can't replicate it here, of course, but I'm wondering if there's anything that we weren't able to get to or didn't bring up that you want to offer as any kind of final thoughts about the project.
I think the kind of the main message maybe for scholars is that it can be really rewarding to experiment methodologically and to come up with ways that allow us to hear the opinions of young people and to hear the opinions of people that aren't often listened to and aren't often represented in academia. I think that's maybe something I'd like to highlight. That for me, using more participatory approaches and using the form of a docudrama really allowed me to gain access to views that I feel are otherwise missing in this debate. And their research can really help by creating a platform for young people that are often vilified and not necessarily listened to.
Yeah, I hope people will check out the docudrama, because that really, I hadn't really heard of these types of approaches before. But it does seem like, after viewing that and reading the book in relation and hearing the kind of background together, that it was really seems like a very productive way to access kind of new perspectives that would have been limited to most researchers. So,
yeah. The only caution or caveat maybe here is that it was quite a time-consuming project, and Quranic students are very busy, so they have their studies. They need to earn their living. So, in a way, I wish I had been more aware of how much time it would ask of them. And so it's maybe something to bear in mind.
Yeah.
And there were also the suspicions about a project run by a Westerner, a foreigner, and what the underlying motives were. Where the students who participated in the film project were suspected of hiding money that I was presumably making with this film, or of being dupes, that they work for me and that I make a lot of money with this film and don't give it to them. So there were, all kinds of suspicions as well, that I think it's important to anticipate, or that are difficult to anticipate, but that can mess with these kind of projects.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the things you've been working on since this project?
Yeah, so I've followed the COVID pandemic a bit in Kano, and so I'm interested in exploring a bit the securitization of Quranic education in the context of that pandemic, where Quranic students were very swiftly declared vectors of disease, even though the data isn't there. So that's something I'm interested in exploring. And schools were forcibly closed, and Quranic students were deported to their home states in quite a brutal manner, with schools being cleared at gunpoint in the middle of the night. So I'm interested in exploring the links between kind of this public health crisis and then pre-existing perceptions of these schools as a presumed security threat, and how that has then given rise to quite hostile policies. I am involved in a collaborative project on the impact of the Boko Haram conflict on Islamic education, together with Dr. Yaga Nabuka from the University of Maiduguri, where we are exploring how this conflict has actually affected the working of Islamic schools in the region and perceptions of these schools. So that's something I'm involved in. And then actually, because there was a lot of insecurity in northern Nigeria, I found it difficult to do long-term field work there. And so I have moved to Senegal, where I did research on Islamic education in a transnational setting. So looking at the diaspora and practices of sending children back to Senegal for their Islamic education. And I did field work in New York, in the US, with Senegalese communities there, and on their education or educational decision making and decisions to send children to Senegal for part of their education.
Well, I look forward to reading that in the future as well, and good luck on everything. Thanks for making time to talk about your book.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That was my conversation with Hannah Hochnar about Quranic schools in northern Nigeria, everyday experiences of youth, faith, and poverty, published with Cambridge University Press in 2018.